So how did you become involved with remastering the Halloween 3 soundtrack?
Well, the Halloween 3, what happened is that, you know, this record's been out of print for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and the record deal was made with MCA Records, who then licensed it out to Verez Sarah Band, who at a certain point, you know, the declining sales of the soundtrack, they just stopped making them, and when they were done, when they had sold out everything that they had, they were just done. So, you know, here comes this Halloween 3 soundtrack, now on eBay selling for over $100 because they're collector's items.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did that in 1983, it was made for LP, for vinyl. So you could only get about 22 minutes of music on a side of a record. It was a limit. So I really cut down a lot of the stuff to fit on the record. As far as recently as even this last year, everyone kept saying, "Hey man, could you redo Halloween 3? Do you still have the masters? Could you make more stuff?" I said, "Yeah, I do." And they said, "Oh man, you got to do that. You got to do that." So I elected to just make a collector's item. It would be too complicated to go back through the whole chain of command. Dino De Laurentiis, who was the original producer, they're no longer in business, and
mm-hmm.
you know, it's Universal Studios, and it's all very complicated. So I elected to just make a limited edition Halloween 3 25th anniversary, because here we are 25 years later, and go back and pull out all the rest of the cues that didn't make it in the original record. So on the current Halloween 3 25th anniversary, you've got the original cues and then 13 what I call bonus cues, which are not the principal cues. I mean, it was, you know, the best stuff was already there in the shorter original, but
mm-hmm.
added to, and then it's interesting because the Halloween 3 soundtrack stands alone as a non-Michael Myers movie.
Mm-hmm.
And for the filmmakers, it wasn't a huge hit. It didn't make the kind of stuff, and after Halloween 3, there was a huge demand to go back to Michael Myers and keep making that character. And John Carpenter and Deborah Hill didn't really want to do that. But Mustafa Akkad and Erwin Yablans, the original producers who owned everything, insisted that they could exploit the franchise. And eventually John and Deborah just agreed to just sort of take a royalty check and be not involved anymore. So that was where Halloween 4 came in. And then I was invited by those producers, because I was already sort of a mini John Carpenter clone, to proceed and continue the Halloweens, and I actually asked Carpenter if it was okay by him. I didn't want to do anything that would cross his path, because he was my good buddy.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "No, don't worry about it. Just, you know, go for it. Make it your own thing." So, and so I embarked on Halloween 4 after Halloween 3. Did the best I could at the time, and it still stands as, I think, one of the best Halloween theme scores.
Mm-hmm.
It was really an adventure. I tried it much more spooky and textury. When I was in the band business in the 70s, I was very much into all these English concept bands, the Moody Blues, Pink Floyd, King Crimson. So I brought all those influences forward into my film scores, and I was very pleased with what we came up with.
You mentioned a few of the things that are different. Is there any changes to the cues, or is it just sort of additional music to the Halloween 3 album?
Yeah, the cues that were in the original record are standalones. They are the cues, and they're the most interesting, and they're full length. I didn't cut them down, because the cues on their own were just fine. So it's basically the entire content of original Halloween 3, as well as these additional tracks. So there's actually 26 tracks now on the reissue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so are we going to see any more of your Halloween scores given this sort of same treatment?
Well, Halloween 4 and 5 could be revisited. Halloween 6, we'll see. It's still in print with Verez Sarah Band, and that's through Miramax Dimension Films. So there would be a bunch of contractual stuff before that would be revisited. But 4 and 5 could be revisited. I have the rights to those also.
Okay. Now, each one of the Halloween films, the main theme changes slightly. How did you approach each film making this iconic theme sound that little bit different?
Well, let's just go back to the original Halloween score done by John Carpenter prior to my meeting him and even knowing about him.
Mm-hmm.
So that was done in a studio where the principal instrument was the piano, and then a fellow named Dan Wyman, they worked at a studio called Sound Arts, and Dan Wyman did all the programming of the synthesizer sounds. And so Dan contributed the what we'll call the musical electronic orchestrations to that first one. When it came to Halloween 2, John was now already committed to making the movie The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he pretty much said, what I want you to do is just take my original Halloween score, transfer it to a bigger multi-track, so you got empty tracks, and just dub in my performances of the various themes, and gave it that more of that darker gothic organy thing using sequential circuits Prophet 5 and 10 synthesizers. And so literally the score of Halloween 1 is the score of Halloween 2 with my overdubs.
Yeah.
All right, so Halloween 3, as we discussed, was a departure, and musical textures were what it was, revisiting all the latest technology that had grown. Then Halloween 4, being now my solo mission, I went, as I said, for this more spooky, dark, textury, echoey versions of them, and I was originating now, so I was performing everything over again, so that gets to be that. And at the time now, we were into MIDI, and we had computer sequencers, so I could play into a sequencer and quantize and adjust and edit the performances prior to them being recorded. So now the MIDI sequencing impacted what we could do, because I could now, on one track, have two, three, or four synthesizers playing simultaneously and create these much thicker textures. Then when we came to Halloween 5, the director really was looking to sort of revisit the original, and we focused again on the piano. So it was a very much a piano score, although it was still a real piano. I had, at that point, acquired a thing called a synclavier,
mm-hmm.
Which was a big digital sampling instrument, and that was sort of my first big sampler, where we now play digital recordings of real instruments as opposed to oscillators and filters of analog synthesizers.
Mm-hmm.
So I overdubbed just pianos on top of pianos, and it gave it that feel. Then we got the Halloween 6. I took the opportunity to now include drums and guitars, and it's sort of a rock version of Halloween with electric guitars being played on the theme and much more drums and drum tracks being dubbed into the cues. So each one grows. The producers, especially Mustafa Kadolians, always insisted that every time we see Michael Myers, we hear dun 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 dun, which is his identification and his presence. And certainly when he's chasing, there was that original Halloween cue that goes bomb, 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 bomb. And so it was variations on those themes each time.
Okay. Now, a lot of your work, well, the majority of your work is done on synthesizer. What do you think is the biggest change in electronic music from when you started?
Well, I just recently scored a movie called The Headless Horseman, which actually is out on Saturday night as the featured film for the Sci-Fi Channel. And on this one, I've now everything is pretty much, there are no tape recorders. The computer is the recorder and the sequencer and the digital file player. And I've added these what they call virtual instruments. So there is no keyboard anymore. There is a keyboard as far as the black and white notes, but that drives over either MIDI or USB into the computer, and the computer plays all the sounds now. So there's a huge change. There's what we call virtual instruments. So this is a software based instrument that lives within a channel of a sequencer. I use Logic right now as my main sequencer. And so within Logic, I can now, on each channel, create a virtual instrument. Well, I added what's called the VSL library, the Vienna Symphony Library. So the Vienna Symphony literally built a recording studio to record themselves and make a product that is a virtual digital orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
So now incorporating this stuff into my scoring is a big sonic change for me. I mean, people are always asking for the big orchestral Hollywood score. Well, at these low budgets, you don't get to hire real orchestras. So I took the opportunity to now add the Vienna strings to my stuff. And so with the director Anthony Ferranti, we've got this new score that is very orchestral. You know, now I have real recordings of great violins played by real people that know how to play. And also within the instrument, normally when you do it on a keyboard, you have one sound at a time, and sometimes there's velocity changes, so if you play it harder, the sound changes, but it's still one sound. Let's say that it's legato strings or pizzicato strings, and then you would make several tracks combining all those things into a performance. Well, now there's switching, so that much like it used to be on a B3 organ, if you remember, there was the black and white keyboard of which the main notes were white, and there was this other thing where it was all inversed. And they would switch sounds by doing different switching. Well, you could do the same thing now. So on your left hand, you can switch from pizzicato to legato to crescendo to various kinds of attacks in real time. So you can perform much like a real violin player performs, switching these attacks and all the nuances. So now the string parts that you play are very realistic. I mean, we're now, it's kind of the difference between when visual effects were rotoscoping and inserts, and now we got to the modern CGI. This is sort of like CGI for music now. Mm. And so the sound palettes that are available are phenomenal. I just really enjoyed it. And, you know, having new sounds is always inspirational. You know, if you keep playing the same sounds over and over again, it's like, all right, I did this before, so what? But when you got a new sound and a new instrument and a new sound palette, it inspires me to play. Mm-hmm. And so I believe, actually, this Headless Horseman score that I just finished and another one I did right after that, which hasn't been released, a movie called Evolution, represents state-of-the-art for me and a whole new level of composition that I've never done before.
Well, now, as a composer, your job is, of course, to write music. But do you also use silence as a composing tool?
Well, certainly. Example, I worked on a movie last year called Boo. Director was Anthony Ferranti. It's a sort of a bunch of kids wind up in a haunted hospital. And very interesting on that one, the movie was scored originally with a composer that used all these virtual instruments, so it sounded orchestral. But it was a bunch of cues that were literally made without watching the movie. So it was just like cuts from a record, and they were edited in. And the person who edited the stuff in was very heavy-handed. I mean, it was just too much music. And so what happens is you lose the impact of your music if it's just always playing. It becomes wallpaper. It goes to the background. Even if you play it loud, you just don't pay attention to it anymore. The ear wants to hear new stuff constantly. So I went through the entire movie and reduced the amount of music in that film by 50%, and then scored little tiny thin tension cues and made it all work. Because that's how these horror movies work, is the alternation of sound and silence. And we'll take silence also to mean there could be a sound, but it's not a big sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's say somebody's coming down the steps and we want to tell the audience that there's something horrible somewhere, but we don't know where yet. Well, we have this little small high string just playing. And it's very quiet. And we lay low. And then when the guy with the knife shows up, all of a sudden it's loud and it goes, BAM! Well, when that happens, you're shocked.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were to play loud music going down the steps going, bam, dam, ding, dee 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 ding, there's no shock when the bad guy comes out.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's a great quote in movie sound by a fellow named Ben Burt, who was the original sound designer of Star Wars. So he was really the creator of this whole new genre of sound effects that was a combination of electronics and recordings and tape manipulation. And they asked him one time, Ben, how do you get those great explosions? And he says, I just make sure it's really quiet just before something blows up, so that you have this huge dynamic change from quiet to loud. And that's the trick. That's the trick in these things, is to lay low and to hold back until it's the moment to fire off your weapon. And so that I learned from John Carpenter. You know, he showed me that style and that technique when we were doing all of his movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, scoring a film can be fairly stressful because of tight timelines and that sort of thing. What do you do to relax?
Play music.
Oh.
You know, just listen to other people's music. You know, what happens is you sit in a studio, it's a, you know, some sort of a soundproof room with all your instruments, and to me it's like a sound starship. Via the sound, the room goes anywhere. So if you've been hovering around this particular movie, which is like orbiting a planet, you know, I'll put on some other people's music and listen to Pink Floyd, or I'll listen to an old King Crimson, or I'll listen to Tool. And just be inspired by other people's works, and then go back to my own work, and that recharges my batteries.
Okay. Well, how would a score that you write today differ from one you wrote, let's say, 10 years ago?
Well, we already discussed, I've got all these virtual instruments, so it's much more orchestral now.
Yeah.
Unless someone specifies, I want you to imitate what you did for Escape from New York and make it all synthesizers, I would do that. In fact, I did that. I scored, very interesting, there was a French documentary on John Carpenter done about 2 years ago. And so I scored it imitating our scores from the early 80s. And so I there was literally virtual versions of the Prophet 5 called a Pro 53, which is an all software version of these analog keyboards. And I used those, and it was great. But anyhow, how would it be different today? I always like interaction. So if the director is very involved, I'm still okay with them being in the room with me and sitting while we do stuff. And in fact, if a director has a little musical talent, he wants to sit down and noodle on the keyboard and express his ideas and say, I want something like this here, I'm fine with all that stuff. Whereas if a director is non-musical, and that's very rare now because most young directors are still rock musicians of some sort from somewhere in their past, then it's like, well, just give me your ideas, go away and come back in a couple of days and I'll show you what you got and give me your input. So then I just sit in the room by myself and go into this world that's created by this movie, whatever it is, and focus on underscoring the emotion. What do we want the audience to feel about whatever they're watching? And that is really the essence of film score. John Carpenter quoted one time, he said he felt that music was the director's velvet glove. It was the way to touch your people with sound and communicate to them what is the message of the movie via music. So I went to the school of John Carpenter, and I carry that with me forward. That'll always be with me. You know, I never sat down and took apart a Jerry Goldsmith score or a John Williams score or a James Horner score to try to figure out how do they do it. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it's a technical exercise, number one. And second, that's for the guys that are in the business of providing sound-alike scores. So I could see very easily a young composer learning all that stuff and having the full technique of everything that Elfman does and everything that John Williams does and everything that James Horner does, so that he can make scores that sound like those guys, but he does it cheap. Now, being almost 30 years into this, I think people come to me for what I do. And if I'm not the right guy, then that's fine, because there are movies that I'm just right for, and what I do is correct. So I just work at being a better version of me. The other thing I would say is, on the Halloween 3, if someone wants to get it, the website that I'm using as my fulfillment house is buysoundtracks.com, and it's S-O-U-N-D-T-R-A-X, buysoundtrax.com. And someone wants to get the Halloween 325th thing, they should order it from there right now.
Okay, and it is limited, 1,000?
There's 1,000 copies, so grab them. If I did any more than that, I have to do a whole bunch of negotiations and get involved with big corporations that I don't want to deal with right now.
Well, like I said, Alan, thank you very, very, very much.
Sure, and certainly as part of my wishes to all the gang out there, happy Halloween.
Well, happy Halloween to you.